Welcome back to the Renaissance, episode 191, Ray. We're talking about the beginnings of the Reconquista, the Christian reconquest of Spain from the Muslims. We, at the end of the last episode, we were talking about the Battle of Covadonga.
Right.
Happened in the early 700s, not long after the Muslims had arrived there and started their conquest. We had this guy called Pelagius who fought back and created the Kingdom of Asturias. And that becomes sort of the inspiration for the Christian reconquest. Now, they're like, we have Jesus on our side and he can do anything. Can he help us take back these lands like in a week? No. Like Jesus can do miracles, right. But come on.
Everything's got come time. Everything in its own time. Yeah. I think you're fine.
Like, you got to understand that a day
right.
for Jesus is like 400, 600 years for us. So he's working his ass off, but it just seems like it's taking a long time. You know how
you're on a different time.
The disciples and Paul believed that he was going to return in a matter of days. And it's been, at this point, 700 years, and he's not back yet. It's just because I don't know if I'd say this out loud, but Jesus has ADHD. He can't.
As soon as he remembers.
Can't focus.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can't find the door.
He's not very good at focusing on. He's like squirrel, and he's distracted.
And there's 1,000 years right there. But here's what most people don't know, and this is a historical fact. When people started saying, "Hey, Jesus can help us retake this land," there was this godforsaken, annoying Aussie in the back of the room who raised his hand. Then why didn't he help you protect it in the first place? Oh, shut up. Mm. Shut up. Mm. That's not the point. The point is they slipped one by him, but he's going to help us. We're just going to need a couple hundred years, but we're all good. If I could give a postscript when we ended the last episode, and I mentioned that Muslim army getting their ass handed to them just north of the Pyrenees, there was another battle. I don't know if we're going to go into this. I'll just make this short and sweet. There was another battle, the Battle of Tours in 732. And there, again, the Frankish forces led by Charles Martel, the grandfather of Charlemagne the Great, stops the Muslim advance. So eventually the Muslims are going, you know what? Our luck changes when we go north of the Pyrenees. How about we just enjoy what we have? And in a way, that was good, because if the Christians can get them out of the Iberian Peninsula, they're gone, because it's not like they've also taken France and maybe a part of Western Germany. So the point is, the problem is here, and so they have to deal with it here.
Kind of reminds me of Jon Stewart's Daily Show episode this week. He was talking about the eclipse that happened this week, and there was some... apparently some Christians in your country that thought it was a sign from God about gays or
everything,
whatever,
everything.
And he's like, God was like, all right, I'm going to send these people a sign that they're on the wrong track. Oh, what are you going to do, God? Is it going to be a plague? Yeah. Are you going to, you're going to create earthquakes and destroy cities?
Yeah.
Yes. I'm thinking just like 4 minutes of semi-darkness.
I'm going to tone it down from the arc. I think I went too far.
We'll give them a little four minutes of semi-darkness.
A little boo. Just a boo.
4 minutes of shade. That should be enough. We don't have to.
Now
we don't have to go overboard here.
If they don't repent after that, well, the sky's the limit. but this is their warning. So hopefully they'll listen. Yeah. Anyway.
It's the vibe of the thing. You know, it's...
it really is.
They'll get it.
It really is.
They'll get it.
Don't kill the messenger.
They'll pick it up. Yeah, I'm becoming a lot more subtle in my old age.
I'm getting older now.
A little bit of darkness.
I don't like to kill as much as I used to. I just like to scare a little bit for their sake.
Floods? I've done floods. Yeah. You know, yeah. I've done plagues. I've done locusts.
Everything. I flooded that entire fucking planet. So,
I don't like to repeat myself.
No.
One in, one out. Yeah, try different things.
You know what's that old saying from God? Twice to the well is one trip too many. So I like to change it up. I really like to change it up. Anyway.
So after the Battle of Covadonga, the next major milestone in the Reconquista is probably the Granada Massacre of 1066. So we're jumping ahead 300 odd years.
Yeah. There's a lot of tension and fighting. Yeah.
And a lot has happened in Spain in that 300 years. As I mentioned last time, the Caliphate of Cordoba, sort of the high point of the Islamic period in Spain, had collapsed through succession battles into a group of kingdoms or taifas,
yes,
across the Iberian Peninsula, sort of in a weakened state. They're not aligned, most of them, so most of them have become vassal states to the stronger Christian kingdoms. They're paying them tribute, taxes, pariahs, as they're known.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Granada Massacre happens, and it's centered around a Jewish guy called Yosef Ibn Nagrela. Joey Nags to his friends. Joey Nags was the vizier to the Berber monarch Badis Ibn Habus, who was the king of the Taifa of Granada.
Nice.
So he's got a Jewish vizier.
Yeah.
We talked in the last episode about how Jews and Christians were mostly welcomed and tolerated in the Umayyad dynasty, the Muslim kingdoms.
And had jobs. Some of them had good jobs, like this guy.
Yeah. And this king, Ibn Habus, known for his patronage of the arts and sciences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is getting on in the Muslim golden age, right? It's sort of 1066, as I said. But, you know, Granada had developed a reputation as a center of learning and culture in the Andalusian Muslim empire. And he attracted scholars and poets and artists, really turned the city into this intellectual and cultural magnet for great thinkers around Europe.
Oh, yeah.
Joseph, not only the vizier to the king, he was also the leader of the Iberian Jews. Oh, don't know a lot about him, but his father was a rabbi and also the vizier before Joseph. So Joseph sort of kept it in the family, which tended to happen with the viziers. We saw that in Baghdad, right? It was sort of a passed on from father to son sort of deal.
Yeah, Fox and Sophie are going to take over this podcast when we're gone. So, yeah, it's their great honor. Their great honor.
Yeah. Fox was on a podcast recently.
Oh, cool.
There's a new library built in our neighborhood, and he and Chrissy were down there one day, and one of the librarians approached and said, "Hey, we're recording a podcast. Would you like to be on it?"
Yeah.
And they were like, "Yeah." And they said, Do you know what a podcast is? And he was like, "Bitch, do you know who my father is?" Yeah, he's literally the child of a podcast.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
Mm. So,
oh, that was good.
Joey Nags, gets himself into a bit of hot water.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because he's Jewish and because he has a high position, he's got enemies. I mean, like Cam and I are the top of our game. I think that's pretty obvious. So we have a lot of detractors. We have a lot of enemies. But Joey had one particular one called Abu Ishaq of Elvira. Now, I think of Elvira. I hear Elvira, and I think of, you know, the long hair and the big. Anyway, the point is, this person doesn't like the Jew having this powerful position. Maybe it's mutual. I have no idea. And what does he do? What does this Abu do? Oh, that rhymed. He writes, wait for it, a malicious poem against Joseph. Because that's how you did it back in those days. You hurt him, you cut him while rhyming. And that's what he did. But unfortunately, the king didn't think much of it because it's like, I know Joe. Joe's a good guy. Joe's my buddy, whatever. I'm not going to listen to your dumb poem. However, the people were a little worked up. And Cam, I'll let you take it from here.
It was a diss rap that he did.
Sorry.
Well, there's another dimension to the story here.
Sure.
It seems that at some point, Joey Nags got involved in some palace intrigue, which backfired.
Yeah.
And the kingdom ended up in a crisis as a result. The 1906 edition of the Jewish Encyclopedia says that Arabic chroniclers believe that Joey believed neither in the faith of his fathers nor in any other faith.
Oh, shit.
So apparently at some point, Joey Nag sent messengers to the ruler of a neighboring taifa,
right,
one of the enemies of Granada, and promised to open the gates of the city to them if they promised to install him as king in exchange for his allegiance.
Oh, shit. That's something you better do right, or you don't do it at all. Yeah. Anyway, but sorry,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. You come at the king, you best not miss, as Omar said. Yo, weebie.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, classic play.
Sure,
He's like, listen, I'm as smart as this fucking... I'm basically running the joint anyway.
Might as well make it official.
Might as well give me the badge. So he makes his play. Apparently, this enemy king, Al-Mutasim,
right,
agrees to the deal.
Oh, shit.
Says, yep, fucking sounds good. But at the last minute, pulls out, like you have many times.
Right.
But instead of coming on Joseph's tits, the word got out.
Right.
I don't know which happened first, but the word got out about the plot.
Yeah.
And so... whether or not that's why Mutasim pulled out or not, or which came first, the chicken or the Jew, I'm not sure. But
sorry.
On the 30th of December, 1066.
Good year.
The people of Granada heard about this plot to overthrow their kingdom,
right,
being led by Joey Nags. And they stormed the royal palace, mm-hmm, where he had gone into hiding. And again, according to the Jewish Encyclopedia, he was found hiding in a coal pit, having blackened his face to make himself unrecognizable. Now, turns out the people weren't that angry about him trying to overthrow the kingdom, but he was wearing blackface.
No,
you
can't do that.
That's right. You can't do that. He was doing this. Oh, mama, song.
If you knew mammy, how I love you. I knew mammy.
He's doing the black and white minstrels, and they're like, dude,
you just can't
do that anymore. Like, that was acceptable,
right,
in the 20s.
But not.
But 100 years ago. Before, not,
yeah, no, you can't.
No, you can't.
Yeah,
it's not acceptable anymore.
I'm just glad you didn't do the hambone. So very thrilled. Please continue with your story.
Well, it's because my audio thing's not working. Right. And if it was, I would definitely be doing that.
So anyway, they were most displeased.
Yeah, he was killed. His body was hanged on a cross.
Yes. Isn't that a little ironic? Go ahead.
Then they massacred the entire Jewish population of Granada,
right,
because they believed they were all in on it. Now, the Jewish Encyclopedia claims that 1,500 families, 4,000 people fell in a single day. That was the 1906 version. Later versions of the Jewish Encyclopedia took that out, the numbers, and just said, look, there was a lot, but they couldn't verify because it happened 1,000 years earlier, obviously. But there was the poem that you mentioned that was published just before the execution,
right,
of the pogrom. It said, do not consider it a breach of faith to kill them. The breach of faith would be to let them carry on. Damn. They have violated our covenant with them, so how can you be held guilty against the violators? How can they have any pact when we are obscure and they are prominent? Now we are humble beside them as if we were wrong and they were right.
Mm.
And that spurred people on. Now,
that's juicy.
If the allegations about Joseph conspiring to overthrow the kingdom are true, he deserved execution, but the rest of the people probably weren't in on the plot. But, you know, people were incensed and, they went crazy. And, you know, we've seen pogroms happen. Throughout Europe,
yes,
in the thousands of years that Christian kingdoms were ruling Europe. Same thing happens here. Definitely a massive tragedy
yes.
to all of the Jews living there. But it seems that the massacre of the Jews became an issue for the Christians around Spain.
Right.
Not that they cared much about the Jews, obviously, because they were having their own little pogroms.
Right.
But it was something like that that was easy to turn into a justification for wars against typhus like this, because they're basically saying, look, if they can do that to the Jews in their lands, they can do it to the Christians in their lands. The same way that modern nations used real and fake massacres to justify horrific acts of retribution, like what's been happening in Gaza for the last 6 months.
Oh, yes.
They killed, well, we don't really know, because we now know that the IDF killed a lot of the Jews on October 7th, but they killed, you know, maybe 1,500 Jews. Mm-hmm. Let's go and execute 33,000 men, women, and children as retribution. Happens today, happened back then. People go crazy when they seeking retribution. I mean, 9/11 happened, 3,000 Americans died. You invaded Iraq and Afghanistan and killed millions as retribution.
Yes.
So, you know, this isn't just an old thing that happens. This is humans. Humans go crazy when they feel that there's been an injustice done to them or their people, or even that there might be an injustice done to them. Because we've seen lots of fake things used as justification, like false flag events, etc.
Yeah, and like you've said countless times, the Christians could have easily looked at each other and said, hey, they might be Jews, but the enemy of my enemy is my friend, at least until we get this over with. So again, it's just another way for Jews to, if they have to pick a side, they're certainly not going to pick the side that just recently killed, you know, wiped out an entire town. So another, you know, another plank in the this is why we should get rid of the Muslims. And the Muslims are certainly giving them plenty of reasons to do this, but the Christians are wisely using everything they're getting. They're organized, and they're, like you said earlier, they're continuing to push south.
And as I said earlier on, you know, when you're trying to convince your population to go to war and put their lives on the line and the lives of their sons on the line and their fathers, you can't say, hey, we're going to go to war with these countries because I want to take their lands because so I get richer. But I'm not going to share any of that with you because basically fuck you. You have to package it up. And one way of doing that is saying there are atrocities being committed, and they're going to come after Christians next, and we need to go and stop them. A bit like, you know, fighting Hitler in World War II. Well, they're committing atrocities, and if we don't stop them, then they'll come for us kind of thing.
Right? Exactly. Now, having said that, Seville and Aragon will later on have their own programs, but that's it's okay when we do it, but we'll talk about that later. But the point is, The Muslims started out tolerant and accepting, and they were benefiting from that. Now they're starting to unravel. They're starting to kill wantonly, or at the very least, the people who do kill are not being punished. The Jews see this. The Christians see this. And it's just working everybody up. This is becoming untenable.
Yeah. So the next major battle between the Muslims and the Christians in Spain was in 1085 at Toledo, a couple hundred miles away from Granada. And the Christian forces were led by Alfonso VI of Leon.
Can I give his background before you get into the battle?
Please.
Because this is going to come into other things we're going to talk about later. So let me introduce you to Alfonso VI. He's born in 1040 or 1041, we're not sure. He is nicknamed the Brave, And in time, he will become the king of Leon, starting in 1065. He will become the king of Galicia in 1071. He will become the king of Castile in 1072. But that's in the future. The point is, Alfonso VI here, or Al VI, if I may, he's the son of King Ferdinand of Leon, Ferdinand I, who helped establish Leon. He has a wife who is, her name is Sancha, and she is the Count of Castile. So, you know, they're already starting to bring kingdoms together through marriage. Not a new concept. Anyways, the important thing is that Alfonso is not the oldest son. There is an oldest son called Sancho. In fact, Al has got a younger brother, too, called Garcia. So there's three boys. And when you're involved in a kingdom and you have three sons, it doesn't end well. So anyways, at the very least, he has been promised by his father that one day he will be the king of Leon. So he's got that going on. Something happens. A couple years later, these boys are grown. They're young men. And their mother dies. And for whatever reason, that was holding them back. Because as soon as mommy's dead, these three boys with their armies start going at each other. And they can quickly see this is not getting anywhere. This is a waste of time. So Alfonso supports Sancho in attacking Garcia, the youngest boy. Garcia loses, but you don't want to be cruel. He is locked up in a prison somewhere. So now Alfonso and Sancho sign a truce because everything is hunky-dory until it's not. They start fighting again, and Alfonso loses. But his sister, before he can be locked in a tower, Urraca steps up for him, and she pleads with Sancho to let him go. Sancho says no. He starts besieging one of Urraca's properties when suddenly Sancho was killed by someone who was pretending to leave Urraca's service. We're not really sure of the details, but the point is, during the siege, the oldest son is murdered. Either way, Sancho is dead and he has no heirs. So Alfonso gets his throne, and he gets the throne of his two brothers. And at the siege, even though we'll go into him later, was one young man called Rodrigo Diaz de Vivar, or you people probably know him as El Cid. He'll get into him later. So anyways, Alfonso rescues his brother, Garcia II, his younger brother, and he goes, "Yeah, I can't trust you." And he puts him back in a jail, and Garcia is going to spend the rest of his life in the jail. Hey, it's the price of being royals. You either win or you lose. So anyways, Alfonso is going to spend the rest of his life taking the fight to the Muslims. But that's just to give you a little taste of who he is. So back to Toledo. I think at the beginning or somewhere in the first episode, we talked about for the Muslims, this wasn't simply a religious thing. They were opportunists like everybody else is. In fact, proving this, in 1075, Alfonso VI has an alliance with the Taifa of Seville, a Muhammad al-Mu'tamid, and they defeated another Taifa of Granada. So again, you got Muslims and Christians working together, going up against people trying to sack places. Why? For money and power. Nothing's changed. A little later that year, Alfonso VI is supporting Toledo against the Taifa of Cordoba. But then Toledo's king is killed by someone. I don't know, Cam, if you know who that is. And the new guy who takes over doesn't like Alfonso, and he kicks out all of his supporters from Toledo. Alfonso's pissed. He's got three kingdoms. He's got an army. They're all pissed. So now we have to see what's going to happen. Cam, do you want to take the story from there?
Yeah, so basically there's a series of wars that happen that Alfonso's involved in. He declares himself emperor. And he spends like the next 14 years expanding his empire through conquest, forging different alliances with different kings of Taifas against other Taifas. He had an alliance with one of his vassal, Al-Ma'mun, who was the Taifa of Toledo, and he was supporting him in a lot of these things. They go and they wage war against the Taifa of Granada, led by a guy called Abdullah. Then he attacks the kingdom of Navarre, run by fellow Christians. So he's not just...
Sure, why not?
Yeah. He's not just fighting Muslims. He's also attacking Christian kingdoms.
Absolutely.
He defeats the kingdom of Navarre, annexes their territory, and adopts the title Imperator Totius Hispaniae, Emperor of all Spain.
Damn right.
So he keeps expanding and subduing Taifa kingdoms, Christian kingdoms. Then in 1074 with Al-Mamun, then in 1074, his friend and vassal, Al-Mamun, the king of the Taifa of Toledo, dies of poisoning.
Ooh.
And is succeeded by his grandson, Al-Qadir. But Alfonso is like, listen, you know, I liked your dad, but you, not so much.
He
lays siege to Toledo.
Right.
Sorry, you just reminded me. Have you seen the finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm?
No. I'm saving it.
Are you watching the final season? Are you at all?
I'm still catching up. Heather is on it, but I'm still catching up.
All right. I won't spoil it for you, but tell me when you watch it, because I think it's like probably one of the greatest finales ever.
Okay.
And is the most Larry David thing to do ever. Like, he's so fucking...
It can't be good.
He's so Larry David-ed that it was... As a Seinfeld fan, as a fellow Seinfeld fan, you'll appreciate how Larry David the finale of Curb is.
Looking forward to it.
But this is there was this thing that just reminded me. Goes, yeah, she was a bit of a cunt. Anyway, it just made me so happy. I watched it last night. And it was just made me so happy, deliriously happy. It was just so well done.
Looking forward to it.
Anywho.
Yeah.
He declares himself emperor of all Spain. He takes Toledo in 1085 after Al-Mamun's dead. Then he besieges Zaragoza in 1086.
Mm-hmm.
Then he changes his title to the Emperor of the Two Religions.
Oh, okay.
Because you know, hey, what about the Jews? People say,
you're wasting my time with that question. What are you doing? Yeah.
I'm not talking about serious religion. They're not a serious religion. But then the Muslims started to fight back. There was a guy from the Maghreb, North Africa, an Almoravid emir, Usuf ibn Tashfin. He crosses the Strait of Gibraltar in 1086.
Right.
Some of the guys that are being besieged, Muslim Taifas, call him over. Hey, dude, he's like the wolf in Pulp Fiction. Right. They need support. He comes in, and he's an emir, basically. I mean, an emir was originally the title of a commander or a leader of Islamic forces, but over time it also basically became like a prince or a duke.
Right.
Maghreb is basically northwest Africa, you know, sort of Algeria, Libya, Morocco, Tunisia, Mauritania. He actually, Usuf ibn Tashfin, co-founded the city of Marrakesh.
Oh, cool.
So he's a big deal.
Yeah.
He arrives on the 23rd of October in 1086 and goes to battle against the troops of Alfonso, something called the Battle of Sagraha. And Alfonso has a large army, not only Christian troops, but some Muslim troops and French knights and mercenaries. Because like Napoleon, he's built this massive coalition of different countries that he's formed alliances with or annexed or turned into vassal states. And Usuf has the Almoravid forces and plus the Taifas that have called on him for support. So two very large armies go to battle at Sagraha. Big battle, very bloody, heavy casualties on both sides. But the Almoravids have better tactics by the sounds of it. Right. They're using their infantry and their cavalry very well, sort of shades of Napoleon.
Right, in concert.
Yeah. Whatever, 800 years later.
Right.
Or Alexander, whatever, 1,300 years earlier. So there are a lot of flanking maneuvers to, you know, break up the Christian forces and take them down.
Ah.
The Christian forces had numerical superiority, according to the sources, but weren't able to withstand the Almoravid tactics. They get defeated and return to Toledo to lick their wounds.
Right.
Unfortunately, Usuf, the emir, doesn't take advantage of the defeat of the Christians. You know, classic military strategy is you hunt them down.
Wipe them out.
And you don't let them lick their wounds and regroup. You go down, you crush them.
Like my lovemaking. Right? Go ahead. It's fine.
And, but his son died back in Africa.
Right.
He left his son in command of things back in Africa. His son dies. He has to rush back to Africa, a bit like Napoleon having to rush back to France when he was in Egypt because the dictatorship was collapsing. So the Christians get to live another day.
Yes.
And this is where Alfonso reconciles with El Cid, who you mentioned earlier.
Right. Right, yeah.
Who had fought against him. El Cid had fought for Sancho in one of their battles.
Yeah.
So now they form an alliance. Now, El Cid, obviously famous Spanish folk hero, been a couple of movies made about him.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was a big one. It was like in the 50s. Who was Charlton Heston. Who played El Cid? Was Heston?
Yes.
I thought it was Heston.
He does all the big biblical whatever you want to call it. I don't know. Yeah, that was him.
1961.
They had to darken him up a
Charlton.
Little bit. Yeah. I mean that, no disrespect.
Blackface on. No,
in this case, brown face. But yeah.
Sophia Loren.
Oh my God, don't. I'm going to need a minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm done. Okay. Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead.
El Cid has a reputation, and had a reputation at the time, of being a formidable military leader, sort of a mercenary, though, this guy.
Oh, yeah.
Born in 1043, so he's in his early 40s at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
He fought with both Christian and Muslim armies. And the Arabs called him Al-Sayyid, the Lord or the Master, which, you know, in Spain, in the Spanish, got turned into El Cid or El Campeador, the champion in Spanish, as he was known. And so he fights with Alfonso. And for the next 30 years, Alfonso was on the defensive as the Muslims were trying to crush him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's able to retain Toledo with the support of El Cid. And he then asks the Christian kingdoms of Europe to organize a crusade against the Almoravids, who had recovered by this stage almost all of the territories that he had conquered except for Toledo.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, Ray, leads us into a discussion of the First Crusade.
Ooh, here we go.
In our next episode.
Love it!